This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Life Marked, Book 5 of the Fate Marked Epic. Written by David Estes. Performed by Derek Perkins. Part 1. Anise, Helmuth, Shanti, Gareth, Bane, Roan, Rhea, Grey, Terin, Lisbeth, Falcon, Zelda, Kristoff.
I shall do what I've been born to do. Rule. Protect the North. Improve the lives of our people.
Archer Garrick, deceased. 1. The Northern Kingdom, Gearhead. Circa 532. Anise Garrick. The bells had finally stopped tolling, dropping a curtain of eerie silence across the northern castle city of Gearhead. Outside the city's walls, hundreds of its citizens hid beneath the thick canopy of the forest. Somewhere a baby cried, and Anise prayed to the frozen gods that its parents would find a way to quiet it. For they were being hunted, all of them.
"We must make our stand," Terin said, close by Anise's side.
His nearness, as always, was a comfort. She could see the familiar dark look in his eyes, one that spoke of raw power and unspent violence. She knew he would fight to the last breath if she asked him to. But she wouldn't ask, at least not yet. Remaining silent, she watched the city, searching for any indication that their enemy had breached the walls.
"Our enemy," she thought,
extending the idea to all the four kingdoms. For the first time in their long history, each kingdom and empire had a common enemy, one that wanted to destroy them all. The Horde. The barbarian mountain tribes hailing from northern Crimea had been united by her very own uncle Helmuth Garrick, a man she'd never even met. Once he'd been a crippled prince. And now? A pale shape appeared on the wall, using all four limbs as it moved with powerful strides. Then another, and another. Screams arose from within the city bounds, as bright as sunlight on steel.
"My people," she thought.
A knot formed in the pit of her stomach. Her mouth was suddenly dry. She had tried to evacuate everyone. But she had failed, just like she had failed Archer. She could not lose anyone else. There would be a time to fight, she knew, but that time wasn't now. It wasn't fear that drove her decision, but the connection she felt to her people.
"We must flee," Anise said,
the words tasting bitter in her mouth. They were prepared for this, hiding sufficient supplies for a long journey in the very wood in which they now sheltered.
"Anise,"
Terin started to say, but she cut him off with a steely stare.
"Your Highness,"
she corrected. Yes, this was the man she loved, as familiar to her as wind to a bird's wings. But in this moment she had to treat him like any other.
"That was a command. Go!"
She saw the flash of indecision cross his face, but then he nodded and backed into the forest, motioning for several of the soldiers to follow him. She watched him leave, and she was glad to see his leg had finally stopped leaking blood. He still hadn't told her how he'd injured it, but it was the least of her concerns. She turned back toward the city, her breath catching at the sight. Amidst the hunchbacked barbarians stood a dark-cloaked man, standing upright, facing the forest. Though she knew she was well hidden in the shadowy wood, she swore he was staring right at her. Crows wheeled about his head, cawing. Though the day had previously been clear, a dark, unnatural mist swirled about him. He held something aloft with one hand, a body garbed in armor. And Anise knew. This was the scout from the tower, the one she'd met as he was ringing the bell. He'd stayed until the last. He'd paid the ultimate price for his loyalty. With a great heave, the man she knew as her uncle, the lost son, the one the barbarians called Kla Gra, tossed the man from the wall. Anise refused to turn away, though she desperately wanted to. Instead, she watched the body fall until it hit the ground, bouncing slightly before coming to rest. Broken. The scout had died to save them. She had to make his sacrifice mean something. Just before she followed Taryn into the woods, she saw her uncle draw his thumb across his throat in a swift motion.
"He knows I can see him," she thought, gritting her teeth.
Hundreds of refugees stole through the forest, and Anise hated that it had come to this. 2. The Northern Kingdom, Gearhead. Helmuth Gerig. Helmuth watched them go. Though he could not truly see his prey in the shadowy confines of the forest, he could sense the displacement of leaves and branches and air. He could feel their pain and fear, too.
"Succumb to it," he thought, "and you shall be free."
It wasn't true, he knew, for no one was ever free from the fear. Everyone had demons, and being haunted by them was akin to sleeping with snakes in one's bed. Ever present, they wriggled and squirmed, and you never knew when they would bite you. For Helmuth, returning to these lands was like waking up from a long sleep, and he could almost believe he was a boy again. His eyes would flash open, the final memories of a beautiful dream dying before his very eyes, as sunlight streamed through his window. He would roll from his bed, ready to dance and run and fight foes by the hundreds, his preordained victory cheered by thousands of adoring citizens who would throw hope flowers at his feet everywhere he walked. It was always that first step that got him. The moment of joy would shatter as his knees buckled, his withered legs unable to hold even his minuscule weight. He would cry out as he fell, scraping his palms and bruising his knees. It was usually at that point that one of two things would happen. On a good day, little Zelda would burst through his door, locating his crutches and helping him to his feet before anyone was the wiser to his folly. But on a bad day, one of his brothers, typically Wulfric, would enter the room first, his voice full of scorn, his laughter carrying through the whole of the castle. It was on the latter days that Helmuth's demons took up personal residence. But now his brother, the dread King of the North, was dead.
"And I am not."
He became aware of the grey mist billowing from the spot on his chest where the pain mark burned, curling around his legs, his arms, his head. His own army shrank back from him, for they were no strangers to the effect of the smoke. It was Helmuth's turn to have the last laugh, even as he stood on two legs, a warrior and commander of the most feared force the world had ever seen. But he didn't laugh, did not even smile. No, there was work still to be done, and he would not laugh until he was drowning in the blood of his enemies. His horde was impatient, the sounds emanating from the backs of their throats like the snuffles of an entire pen full of hogs. But they would have to wait a while longer, for he had waited his entire life for this, and he would relish every moment, basking in the fear and pain of a world that had turned its back on him long ago. He'd never had a chance, and now neither would they.
"Run, little squirrels," he thought. "Run."
The horde would eventually catch their prey, and then they would feast. Helmuth turned to the south, gazing at the peaked forms of the snowy mountains, the only barrier between the north and the rest of the kingdoms. And cutting between them like a silver throat, the Snake River as it made its way through Raiders Pass. Something about it felt like the door to destiny. He wouldn't knock. No, he would kick it in. 3. The Northern Kingdom, 2 days later. Anise Gerig. Anise awoke in pieces. There was the child who played snow wars, outfighting the boys, ignoring their japes and taunts as she beat them into submission. There was the confused and angry young woman seeking escape and a new life. And there was the queen, strong, confident, fearless. Which of these pieces was the truth? "All of them," she thought. "I am all of them."
"It's time to go,"
Taryn whispered in her ear. One of his muscled arms was wrapped tightly around her, his knees pressed to the backs of her legs. Despite only getting 4 hours of sleep, Anise was wide awake in an instant. Fear did that to a person. And though she feared not for herself, the fear of failing her people had driven her the last 2 days. On Anise's orders, the refugees slept for only half the night, to put as much distance between them and those that hunted them. The horde had not been spotted since that first day, when they'd left Gearhead. Now Anise craned her head back at the same moment as Terin leaned forward, their lips meeting in the middle.
"Stolen kisses," she thought.
It was something, at least. Their enemy haunted their footsteps, but they couldn't haunt their hearts, not yet.
"I love you, Anise,"
Terin said, his voice husky. In another time, another place, she would have given her entire self to him in this moment. But reality was a bony bedfellow.
"I love you, too,"
she murmured against his lips, before breaking away and shoving to her feet. They were already fully dressed, requiring only to step into their boots and then push through the flaps to their tent. Terin wore makeshift armor, pieced together from scraps of plate the blacksmith, Fay, had managed to scrounge up until she could construct a new suit, worthy of the largest knight in the realm. The moment the cool night air hit her skin, several soldiers descended upon their tent and broke it down, packing it away for another long march. Breakfast was still a dozen miles away, but hard bread and dried meat was handed out as their march began. The line of refugees stretched out like a meandering river in the night, disappearing over the crest of a hill. Though their weariness was evident in the way they trudged along, carrying sacks of supplies, skins of water, and small children on their backs, Anise could also see the determination on their expressions. The people of the North had been through hard times and harder times, not the least of which was the rule of Anise's own father, and they were stalwart. If she could only keep them moving, maybe, just maybe, they could survive this. Still, Anise planned to walk the entire line before they made camp again, offering encouragement. It was something that gave her as much comfort as it did her people. Before she could pick up her pace, however, Anise's aunt, Zelda, appeared beside her, mouth half full.
"When we reach Darin," Zelda said, never one to beat around any bush.
"I still don't know," Anise said, sighing.
It was an argument they'd had on more than one occasion. Zelda was of the mindset that they should turn south and make for Raider's Pass. But Anise was not willing to do that, for it would mean abandoning those of her people who'd already been evacuated to the east by Sir Christoph Metz and his squadron of women soldiers. Not only would she be leaving the loyal knight to fend for himself, but Terin's cousin too, Mona Shiri. Zelda, however, refused to give up, as stubborn as an eight-legged mule, as the northern expression went.
"We'll be backed against the cliffs," Zelda said.
This was not an expression, but a truth Anise could not deny. They were retreating into a corner. To the north was the frozen wasteland known as the Hinterlands. To the south were the towering, impenetrable, mournful mountains. And to the east, where they were heading, were the black cliffs, nicknamed the Razor, due to the blade-sharp rocks that were all but unclimbable. Their foes would come from the west, their number as vast as the salt in the sea. And there would be no mercy.
"The East will hear our plea for assistance," Anise said.
They would reach Walberg soon, and if she didn't receive a reply from King Gareth Ironclad there, she would send another stream, requesting a response to be sent directly to Darin.
"And if they don't?"
Zelda's jaws clamped down on a heel of bread, gnawing at it like a dog on a bone. There was only one answer, and it was not to meet the Horde in open battle. Even behind Darin's thick stone walls, they would be outnumbered 10 to 1, perhaps more. It was a fight they could not win, even with a warrior such as Terin in their midst.
"We shall force them to hear us," Anise said,
her words taking on a dangerous tone. Terin coughed.
"What?"
Anise said, glaring at him. He raised his hands, which were as large as the paws of an ice bear, defensively.
"Apologies, Your Highness. I meant no offence. But I have fought the Easterners 50 times. Even doing battle in the frozen north, where we have an advantage, they are a formidable foe. And the way through the mournful mountains is treacherous and said to be full of traps."
Anise wanted to break something. Was nothing simple?
"What would you have me do, sir?"
she said. Despite her frustration, she couldn't pull her gaze from his intense, dark eyes, his smooth, glass-like skin, the lips she'd kissed just minutes earlier.
"Let me lead a party to harry the enemy. At the least we will slow them, and give you a chance to negotiate safe passage to the east."
She didn't doubt his abilities in the least, but...
"Oh, Terran, please don't leave me."
Anise wanted to be selfish, but she also knew she couldn't pick and choose when to be the queen and when to be that stubborn girl who always beat the boys when they played Snow Wars.
"I will consider it."
Terran nodded, his lips parting to say something else, but a newcomer approached before he could.
"Iron Fay," Anise said.
It was the nickname she had heard several people call the talented blacksmith. Anise quite liked it, because it was so appropriate for the woman who now walked beside her.
"Your Highness."
Fay's dark hair was cut short, wind-blown and sticking up in several places. Her tight-fitting white shirt was damp and dusted with pine nettles. One sleeve was badly burned. A large hammer hung from her belt, the ensemble completed by thick woolen trousers and sturdy boots. If not for her long eyelashes and pretty brows, she could easily pass for a man, a knight squire, perhaps.
"What news from the rear scouts?" Anise asked.
Fay had volunteered to be the go-between for the rear scouts, and Anise couldn't deny her. The blacksmith had already done so much for her, not the least of which was designing both hers and Terran's primary weapons. Shadows fell across Fay's eyes.
"The horde was spotted a dozen miles back, but they are closing rapidly. They haven't slept in over a day." "Frozen hell," Anise thought, as she realized what this meant.
Despite their ceaseless march, they'd lost ground over the last day.
"How soon will they catch us?"
Fay swallowed.
"At this pace, 2 days, three at the most."
Zelda threw what was left of her hard bread, and Anise watched it skitter like a rock across the rough ground.
"We won't make Waldburg, much less Darin," she said,
though everyone was already thinking the same.
Terran said, "And your Highness."
"I know," she said,
already resigned to her decision, though making it felt like tearing her heart into two pieces. She'd lost so much already, her mother, her brother, friends and family. But she had no claim on suffering. Still, it felt like she'd only just regained Terran, that they'd finally found a balance they could manage, together. But she was the queen, bound by duty to her people, not to her heart.
"Go,"
she said, raising her voice to prevent it from breaking.
"Take the strongest, bravest soldiers, and slow our enemy. May the frozen gods of the north be with you."
4. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Shanti Parthena Lord. Shanti could see them, the dead. They were all around her, filling the spaces between the living, who were going about their business in the marketplace, oblivious to the ghosts. She knew some of them. Those she'd fought alongside. Those she'd plotted with. Rebels, slaves, great warriors. All dead. Falcon nearly walked into one, and she almost warned him, but then caught herself. If he sensed anything was wrong, he would only watch her more. She jammed her eyes shut and willed the dead to disappear.
Why couldn't they leave her in peace?
Was she supposed to take solace in those who had survived? Is that what normal people did? Before she met Jai, her entire life felt like it was pulled as taut as a bowstring, but then, for just a moment, she'd let her guard down, let herself fall, her bowstring sagging slightly.
Why?
It was the question, the one with no answer. People talked to her sometimes, but their words had as little substance as the wind blowing past, stinging her eyes with the grit it carried. Even Falcon's words were hollow. How could they be anything else? The dead were quieter. Their voices mere whispers, but every word was a pain-filled shout of warning. Shanti heard them. Heard them every second of every hour of every day of every... She stopped, kneading her knuckles into her forehead to combat the pounding headache that had taken up residence. Falcon was speaking again, leaning in close, wearing that expression of concern that had once been so endearing. Finally, the shouted whispers ceased, the silence in the background so abrupt that for a moment Shanti thought she might have lost her hearing completely. But then Falcon's voice cut through the silence like a knife through butter.
"Shanti, are you all right? Are you ill?"
She straightened up, removed her fist from her forehead, and forced a smile to her lips.
"It's just the heat."
"You should lie down," Falcon suggested, his brow still furrowed.
Falcon was a good man, she knew. If she'd never met Jai, she might have been happy with him. She might still be whole. But that wasn't what had happened, and she was far from whole.
"Thank you," she said. "I'm going to do that."
5. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Gareth Ironclad.
"We need to send a reply immediately," Gareth said, still staring at the wet note.
The ink from the stamp marking the message as confidential was running off the paper, dripping red drops to the floor at his feet.
"I'm sorry, Your Highness," the Phoenician streamworker said. "It seems we have run out of ink reeds for Feria."
"What about the North? I can reply directly to Queen Gerig."
The narrow-eyed man shook his head.
"My apologies."
Gareth took a deep breath, determined not to let his frustration affect his actions.
"How close can we send the stream?" he asked, frowning.
"Of all the bad luck."
Saris?"
"Saris? Great Orion, save us all."
"Saris might as well be an ocean away from Feria. Two oceans from the north. By the time the message arrived, it could already be too late. Still, they might have a greater variety of ink reeds in Saris. He had to try."
"Send it. Bring me the ink."
The streamworker bowed stiffly and departed. Though it was daytime, long shadows pushed through the arched windows on the far wall. It took three lanterns to cast enough light to see. Such was life in a canyon, where the sun only managed to find its way to the bottom for a few short hours a day. Gareth sat at a table and read the note for the third time. It had been copied in Feria and streamed to him here in the southern continent of Fanes. It was a request for help from Anise Gerig herself. Her people were under attack, not by another kingdom, but by the same enemy they all now feared, the Horde. "Her army killed my father," he reminded himself. His brother, Guy, had died during the same battle, but at the hands of Bane, the King's Bane. "He's still a Gerig," he thought, his teeth grinding together. "We attacked them," he reminded himself, "because my father could not forgive and forget. Long had the cycle of vengeance turned the wheel of the Four Kingdoms. It must stop." The streamworker returned, and Gareth swiftly penned a reply to Anise, promising her the assistance of the East. He requested that whomever received the note in Saris forward it to every major northern city, from Blackstone to Castle Hill to Darin. Next he wrote another message, this one to his general in Feria, charging him with providing safe passage to the northern refugees. The Phoenician messenger accepted both messages with another bow and left to send them. Gareth leaned back and sighed. It was the best he could do, for now. The Four Kingdoms had no choice but to come together if they were to survive. It should be easy, if not for the stubbornness of its people.
"Speaking of which,"
Gareth muttered, as Gwendolyn Storm, the hero-marked Orion, entered his quarters.
"Gods, she's beautiful," he thought,
though he wasn't romantically interested in the female persuasion. Still, he couldn't help but to admire the litheness of her armored form, each step as graceful as a dance, her silver hair framing her sharp-angled face. Her yellow, cat-like eyes pierced him with a stare.
"I'm leaving," she said without preamble.
She stopped only halfway across the room.
"But you just arrived. In my room, I mean."
"I'm leaving Fanes," she clarified.
"I know," Gareth said. "After the council. Like we agreed."
"I changed my mind. I'm leaving now. Raven must return to Calypso. She cannot wait any longer." Gareth wasn't fooled. They'd been through too much together for her to hide her true intentions from him.
"You haven't spoken to Rhone yet, have you?"
"That's not why—"
"It is,"
and you know it. I can't believe the most fearless woman I've ever known is afraid of the peacemaker.
I'm not afraid. I'd just rather not distract him.
With your beauty, Gareth said, making a show of licking his lips.
With bad memories.
There was no humour in her tone, and Gareth felt bad for his previous remark. Gwen had opened up to him about how she'd last left things with Roan, how she'd disappointed him. But that was the past, and everything had changed, hadn't it?
You should talk to him.
I'm a fool, he thought a second later. Here he was, trying to help the one woman who stood between him and the man he loved. Even worse was the fact that he'd barely spoken two words to Roan himself, and he wasn't sure why.
So should you,
Gwen countered, reading his mind.
We could do it together, Gareth suggested.
That wouldn't be awkward at all. Gareth laughed.
Exactly. It'll be just like old times.
Gwen finally managed a smile, albeit a thin one that suggested she'd rather shoot an arrow through his eye.
I'll talk to him when this is all over.
Gareth wasn't about to let her off that easily. Tormenting Gwen was one of the few things that still gave him pleasure.
I'll make you a deal. I'll talk to Roan first, and then no deal.
You haven't even heard the rest.
You were going to say that I have to talk to him second.
Wrong.
You must stay for the council. Then you can fly off into the sunset with your new best mate.
She's not my save it.
Do we have a deal?
Gwen tucked her bottom lip into her mouth, and then finally flashed a genuine smile.
Deal.
Gareth pushed back his chair and stood.
I'll find you after I talk to him. Don't do anything drastic.
Before she could respond, he swept past her and out of the room. Gareth watched as Roan sat alone in one of the many courtyards nestled between the sheer rock faces of the great Phoenician canyons. Black marble balustrades surrounded the area, which was open only at one end, where a grand staircase connected it to the rest of the palace. The far wall was espaliered with southern fruit trees, their long, vine-like branches climbing wooden lattices secured to the stone with iron bolts. Gareth knew from experience that the small yellow fruit hanging from the branches was exceptionally sweet, and usually tempered with flour and almonds. He'd eaten it for breakfast 3 days in a row, taking the meals in his room, where it was safe.
What am I afraid of? He wondered.
Roan sighed and leaned back, as an errant sunbeam found its way into the canyons, lighting his face. His skin was sun-browned, his hair bleached even more than the last time Gareth had seen him, when Roan had saved his life from Bane in Faria. Again.
He is so beautiful, Gareth thought.
But that wasn't why he feared speaking to him again. No. Gareth, despite being a king now, despite the role he'd played in the victory in the Bloody Canyons, despite having forged an alliance with the West, was still afraid of playing second fiddle. All his life it had been hammered into him that he was the shield, born only to defend his brother Guy, who was destined to become King of the East. But now that Guy was dead, Grian too, he was the heir to the throne. But that didn't make him heir to Roan's heart. He didn't want to compete with Gwendolyn. After all, she never lost at anything. But he also didn't want to walk away without trying.
"Have I become a stranger to all those I love?" Roan said, his voice carrying across the space.
There was something different about it, something more assured, confident.
He knows his purpose.
The knowledge sent tendrils of excitement through Gareth, and he longed to run to him, to fall back into the way things were before.
No, Gareth said. And yes.
He mounted the last step and started toward him, taking short, sharp breaths but feeling starved for air. Roan's eyes were still closed, his head still dipped back, and for a moment it appeared as if the light was coming from within him rather than from the sun above, which wasn't entirely impossible. When Gareth had closed the gap between them by half, Roan finally tilted his head toward him, his eyes fluttering open lazily.
"A contradiction," he said. "You've always been a contradiction."
"Have I?" Gareth said, and suddenly it was as if no time had passed, as if Roan had never saved his life, twice, as if they were back at the beginning, when the world hadn't changed either of them and life was simpler.
Aye, like a snake bite without the venom.
Roan flashed a smile. Gareth found himself smiling back.
Why didn't I go to him sooner?
He's Roan, not some demon.
I could bite you and we could find out, he said.
Roan leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees. I'm worried about Gwen, he said, and the moment of frivolity burned away like thin paper in an inferno. Gareth pretended the abrupt change of topic didn't sting.
I know. Me too. But she's fine. She's changed. We all have.
But in Calip, she told me what happened. She fears you'll never speak to her again.
Roan said, What?
She's the one who ran away. She's the one who was trying to assassinate the Sands.
She didn't.
I know, which is why I don't understand her absence.
Words burned in the back of Gareth's throat, and he wished he didn't have to speak them. But he did, because Gwen was his friend, for better or worse.
She loves you.
I know.
Gareth couldn't help the chuckle that escaped his lips.
You know? Must be nice to be so secure with all the attention.
Roan looked aghast.
I didn't mean... I'm joking, lest you forget my personality.
A shy laugh slipped from Roan's mouth.
Sorry. I just... A lot has happened. Not all of it good.
Tell me. Roan did, and by the end of it Gareth wanted to hit something. Or someone. Specifically, the Western Oracle. If she was still alive, that is.
She created the man who is leading a horde of barbarians across the Four Kingdoms, slaughtering anyone who stands in their path.
Roan nodded.
And you're not angry?
I was, Roan said.
Very. I felt betrayed. All this time I thought the Western Oracle was a noble woman with a grand plan for peace.
And now? A faraway look appeared in Roan's eyes, and Gareth thought perhaps he was remembering something from his time in Terragon.
I think maybe that is still true, but her methods were misguided.
You think? Gareth couldn't help the scorn that entered his voice. Finally, for the first time in over a century, they were on the verge of peace, and now this?
Honestly, Roan said, raising his eyebrows thoughtfully. I don't know any more. All I know is that she died for something she believed in, which is more than most of us will be able to say in the end.
The words weighed heavily on Gareth's mind, especially because of the note he'd received from Anise Gehrig earlier that day.
There's something I have to do, he said. Speak later.
You'll be at the council.
I wouldn't miss it for peace in the Four Kingdoms.
Roan managed a smile, but it vanished quickly.
And Gwen?
She'll be there too, even if I have to drag her myself.
Roan nodded.
His eyes drifted shut once more, and he leaned into the sunshine. Gareth's gaze lingered on him for a selfish moment longer before he slipped away. He needed to know whether his streams to Saris had received a response.
What?
Gareth said, frowning at the dripping parchment.
Saris has no ink reeds at all.
The Phoenician stream worker took a step back, as if expecting to be hit.
Stream locations all over the Four Kingdoms have experienced the same interruption. It seems those responsible for delivering ink reeds are no longer performing their duties.
Gareth couldn't really blame them. Crossing borders during dangerous times such as these was no easy task. Still, frustration prowled through him, like an ore panther through ironwood. How was he to help the Northerners when he couldn't even communicate with them or his own capital city? He could send a messenger the old-fashioned way, but he was no longer willing to entrust such an important duty to someone he didn't know, which left one final option. He would have to ride to Faerûr himself. 6. The Southern Empire, Faerûr. Bane Gehrig. Bane hovered in an ethereal place between worlds, watching as the delegates from each of kingdoms and empires entered the broad banquet hall now being used as a council room. He felt like a ghost, a silent observer. It was not so dissimilar to how he'd felt his entire life.
"I should be a ghost," he thought. "I should be dead."
But he wasn't, if only because Rhone Loren, the peacemaker created and prophesied by the Western Oracle, had healed him from the plague that had afflicted him. He still remembered what Rhone had said when Bane had asked why. "I did it because we need you. Your time is not yet come. I don't know everything, but I know that. And because your last act should be your best one, not your worst."
"We need you," he whispered.
No one had ever needed him. All those he'd met had feared him. The only man he'd ever considered his friend, Shavos the Plague-Marked, had tried to kill him. The man who'd raised him, Bear Blackboots, had abandoned him. But Rhone had not. He'd even invited him to this very place, to take part in the proceedings. Somehow, it only made Bane feel more alone, more pitiful and hated. The first ever fate-marked council was about to begin, and he knew he could not be a part of it, not truly. "For I am not fate-marked," he thought. "I am death-marked." And he had not yet killed the number of rulers required by the prophecy, by the marking split into 10 equal segments on his scalp. No, there was still work to be done. 7. The Southern Empire, Fenia. Rhone Loren. All eyes were on him, and suddenly Rhone's idea for the first ever fate-marked council didn't feel like such a good idea. After all, who was he to guide kings and queens and emperors and empresses toward peace in a land embroiled in war? Rhone could almost hear Garrus's voice responding in his head, "You're the peacemaker, you dolt. Of course it should be you." The thought actually helped, as did seeing Garrus enter the grand room through a side door, a hint of amusement crossing his lips as their eyes met. Rhone wanted to smile back, but then he saw who Garrus was dragging behind him, Gwen. Adorned in the magnificent armor of ironwood, she looked beautiful and strong and... She refused to meet his eyes. Rhone had never seen her look so uncomfortable, a fact that would have been disquieting in the best of times. Rhone shook his head slightly, willing himself to focus. Whether she liked it or not, he would talk to Gwen after the council was finished. He scanned the area before him, which had once been a grand banquet hall used by the Southron Emperor for entertaining the wealthiest and most influential Phoenicians. Under the prismatic light from the crystal-studded chandeliers overhead, slaves would have served him and his guests, largely unnoticed and ignored. Now, however, the space had been converted into a large council room, an enormous circular table brought in and outfitted with a few dozen chairs. Though invitations had been sent to a select group of people, those who were fate-marked or had a direct role in the leadership of their respective nations, the attendees had also been allotted several spots to fill with their counselors, if desired. As such, almost every seat was now taken. From the east, there were Garrus and Gwen, as well as a pair of generals who had served the Iron Realm for more than 2 decades. From the west were Syloren and his siblings, in order of age, Wheaton, Gaia, and Ennis. They were surrounded by several advisers, including the red-garbed, sharp-eyed Furies. Rhone's sister, Rhea, was noticeably absent, having recently given birth to a daughter. Thus far she'd refused to see anyone, attended only by a pair of stubborn midwives who provided cryptic one-word answers to even the simplest of questions. From the neighbouring southern continent of Calip was Raven Sands, who never seemed to be far from Gwen's side these days. The Calypsian Empress had requested that a wall be knocked down so her dragon, Ciri, could attend the council, but the other council members had voted against it. Now, a giant dark eye stared through the east-facing window.
"I see you, peacemaker,"
the dragon said, as its eye met his gaze. Rhone couldn't help himself. He flinched. Though it wasn't the first time the dragon had spoken directly into his mind, it still unnerved him. Raven only grinned, while most of the other attendees shrank back from the dragon's presence. Representing the Phoenicians were Emperor Falkenhoser and several women from a rebel group known as the Black Tears, including Sonic Evade and Shanti Lord, both of whom Rhone had met in the days since the battle. Even the pirates had representation on the council, in the form of a young man who wore a blade for a hand, Grey Aris. His sister, the young half-marked girl who had helped save numerous lives during the last battle, was next to him, followed by the one-legged pirate king who bore the other half of her marking. Their names were Shay Aris and Eric Clawburn, respectively. Last, and perhaps most surprisingly, were the representatives from the north, a Sir Dietrich, who was sword-marked, and the soul-marked woman Lisbeth Lorne. Though several council members had protested their presence, specifically Cy Loren, because they'd been associated with the ancient army known as the Sleeping Knights, who had almost killed them all, Rhone could not deny them. He'd invited Windy Sands and his friend and fellow scholar, Yila, to attend. Though they were Calypsians by birth, he knew them well enough to trust they would favour the interests of the Four Kingdoms as a whole over their country of heritage. Only one who'd been invited was missing, and Rhone pointedly searched the shadows in the corners just in case. He shook his head. Bane would not come, and Rhone hated that he felt relieved. Adding the volatile young man to the mix might have been like creating a spark in a room full of fire-root powder. He refocused on the meeting and its purpose, to make a united decision about how to combat the threat they all now faced. Each ruler would receive one vote, as well as each fate marked, or at least that was what Rhone had stated in the invitations. He opened his mouth to speak, but didn't get a single word out before another voice rang out. "I hereby reject the notion that any of the sin-marked should receive a vote." All heads turned toward where Cy Loren now stood, one fist set on the table, while the other hung at his side, dangerously close to the hilt of his sword. He was dressed in full battle armor, his jaw locked, as if he expected the meeting to end in a fight to the death. Sin-marked. That word. It was a term Rhone had feared his entire life, when it had been taught to him by Markin Swansea while growing up in Calypso. But he feared it no more. A chair screeched across the floor as it was shoved out. Gwendolyn Storm glared at Cy, and Rhone knew he was about to lose control before the council had even truly begun. He cleared his throat and her yellow eyes flashed to his, truly meeting his gaze for the first time since they'd been reunited. Something passed between them, though he wasn't certain what. He gestured for her to sit, and after a moment's hesitation, she did. "Respectfully," Rhone said, keeping his voice even. "Those bearing a mark will hereby be referred to as fate-marked." "Why? Have the fate-marked done anything but bring greater violence to a world already plagued by it?" "No, I say. The sin-marked are unnatural creations, and I consider any who support them my mortal enemy." The words were like darts to Rhone's heart. This was the West he'd been taught to fear, a land of ignorance and mistrust, a land where those different were hated simply because they were different. But was there anything salvageable? He wasn't sure where Rhea stood, but she wasn't exactly available right now, and any hold she'd had on the throne seemed to be fading fast. "The so-called Sinmarked saved your life in the Bloody Canyons," a new voice said. Emperor Falkenhoser was now standing. He wore a leather vest, his muscular arms tanned and bare. His dark eyes were trained on Cy, a note of challenge in them. "Lisbeth defeated the Sleeping Knights with the help of the Half-Marked." The young, willowy, blind girl bearing the soul mark shifted uncomfortably at being mentioned. Rhone had tried to speak with her several times since the events of that day, but thus far she'd been quiet, as if the memories were more than she could tolerate. Sai's upper lip curled with unmasked disgust. "That thing," he spared a harsh glance at Lisbeth, "brought annihilation to our very doorstep. Reports have been arriving all week. The Knights sacked Bethany, wiped Resta from the map, destroyed Cleo. My cities, my people, my kingdom.
Forgive me if I cannot commend her for her actions in the bloody canyons. Do you deny she was responsible for awakening the sleeping knights in the first place?
Roan could not. She'd admitted that much at the least. She'd done it with good intent, to save the North from defeat at the hand of the Easterners, but it was still a bitter truth for someone like Roan to swallow. So much violence spawned by one small act. He shook his head, but not in response.
She lost control, yes, but in the end she stopped them, else we would not be sitting here speaking today.
Ha! Sai scoffed. You may be of Western descent, cousin, but you are Calypsian through and through. Excuses on top of excuses.
Empress Raven Sands, the only true Calypsian on the council, was on her feet in an instant, whip in hand and at the ready. Her throat was punctuated by the growl of the dragon outside, which rumbled through the wall, rattling the table.
Sai's expression blanched.
I'm surrounded by heathens and demons, he said. Now it's time this farce of a council came to an end, at least my part in it.
Wait, Roan said.
All went still and silent.
Sit. Please.
All of you. Glares were exchanged between those still standing, but slowly, one by one, Falcon, Raven, and Sai returned to their seats. Roan took a deep breath.
We have our differences. Even I can admit that.
Sai huffed out a scornful laugh and looked ready to say something, but Roan raised a hand to silence him.
I'm not finished. We have our history, a history filled with violence, mistrust, and hatred. So much blood has been spilled on these lands. But now we face an evil greater than any we have ever known, greater than the differences that have separated us for centuries. This evil does not seek to conquer, but to annihilate. Their goal is not land or power, but destruction.
Roan paused, and he couldn't help but remember that it was the Western Oracle who had created the very situation they now faced. The fresh fires of anger rose in his throat, but he swallowed them down. They might not be fully responsible for the evil that beset them, but that didn't mean they could avoid facing it. His eyes roamed from face to face, meeting each gaze, trying to connect with these people in such a way that they'd be able to feel what he felt. Hope in unity. We must form an alliance of fate-marked and unmarked, king and queen and emperor and empress and commoner. It is the only way to survive the Horde. We are all responsible for the fate of the Four Kingdoms.
He paused, waiting for a reaction.
Waiting for one of them to understand, to extend an alliance that crossed borders and kingdoms.
Sai stood, and Roan held his breath. Bravo! A fine speech. Perhaps it will move the weaker minds in the room, but even with the tip of your sword pressed to my throat, I would not agree to such foolishness. My cousin might have entered an ill-advised alliance with the East, but that is over. The West owes the Four Kingdoms nothing but vengeance. We will defend our borders against the Horde and the rest of you, for you are all alike in our eyes, enemies.
Roan should have felt anger, but the strength of his disappointment outweighed all else. The day had begun with such hope.
Do your brothers and sister share your view?
He asked evenly. Sai glanced to the left and right, as if daring his siblings to contradict him. Wheaton met his gaze with a nod of solidarity, while Ennis refused to meet anyone's eyes. Gaia, however, stood.
I do not, she said.
There was a slight quiver in her voice, but her eyes were full of steel, green and piercing. In some ways, her defiance reminded Roan of Rhea.
Traitor,
Sai muttered between locked teeth.
No, brother, Gaia said, turning to face him. It is you who are the traitor. To your country, to your cousin, to your family. And I will be a part of it no longer.
With that, she stepped past him, shoved her chair beneath the table, and left. Sai's face had turned a dark shade of red, but to his credit, he took several deep breaths before speaking.
You can have my sister, my cousin too. It doesn't change anything. I am the Western King. Do you deny it?
"Yes," said a familiar voice. "I deny it."
Surprised, Roan glanced toward the sound. A woman stood where Gaia had departed only a moment earlier. She wore a long blue gown that seemed to trail from the ends of her golden hair. The silky fabric matched her eyes perfectly, which were the color of a clear sky. She cradled a babe in her arms, rocking it gently from side to side. It took Roan several speechless seconds to realize the woman was none other than his sister, Rhea Loren. The changes in her were significant, not just in her appearance, which was softer somehow, but also in the aura that seemed to surround her. She was calm, in control, a stark contradiction to the young, fiery woman he'd first met back in Night's End, when he felt like she was always on the verge of going up in flames, burning the world down with her. Sai finally broke the silence. "You have no authority here," he said. "You lied to your own people. You murdered my brother. You had your pet sea monster kill your own sister. How dare you deny my claim on the very throne you usurped?" Rhea's expression didn't change during her cousin's tirade, as if the words were pebbles and she was made of impenetrable armor. "She has changed," Roan thought. "Motherhood has worked wonders on her." He had a mind to interject, to defend her, but he knew he didn't need to. Perhaps at one time Rhea Loren needed defending, but not any more. She was her own defense. She stepped forward defiantly. "Under Western law, the throne must pass to the eldest primary heir. And that, dear cousin, is Roan." Roan felt the air rush out of his lungs. Though he'd known for a long time that he was the true heir to the West, he'd never thought to exercise those rights. Furthermore, he never thought he would hear his sister lend her support to his claim. But did he want the throne? He had no desire for power or control, but if being king helped achieve peace... Sai's snarled retort broke through his thoughts. "Foolish child! You know nothing of Western law. Your brother, the primary heir, as you put it, is fate-marked. If he steps foot in the West, then he will be tried and executed in accordance with laws enacted almost 200 years ago." "Brother." Ennis Loren had finally spoken, his eyes locked on Sai's. "Enough with the threats. Just tell them." Roan frowned. "Tell us what?" Sai's gaze flicked to Roan, and he didn't try to hide a look of disgust. "We're leaving. We didn't come here to make peace. We came here to conquer the wrath-hating nation of Fanes. That is no longer a possibility, so we shall return to the West." "Fools!" Roan wanted to shout, but he held his tongue. Over the last several months he'd learned that some people could not be reasoned with. Rhea had been one of those people. But he'd also learned that people could change, just like his sister had. Without another word, Sai departed, his armor rattling. Wheaton frowned, but followed his brother, having not said a single word during the exchange. Ennis's eyes met Roan's, then Gwen's, and finally Gareth's. Gareth looked like he wanted to say something, but only shook his head and looked away. When Ennis stood, however, Rhea moved into position to block him.
"Cousin," she said. "I'm sorry."
A shiver ran through Roan. For Rhea's voice had been stripped down to a single, pure note of honesty. Gone was the deceit and the political maneuvering and the cruel intent. Here was a woman seeking to make amends, to gain the forgiveness of a man she obviously cared for.
"So am I,"
Ennis said, stepping well clear of her and the sleeping baby in her arms as he passed by. 8. The Southern Empire, Fenir. Rhea Loren. Rhea trusted her brother to handle the council, and she couldn't let Ennis walk away. Not again. Not like this. She turned to go, but then her eyes locked on those of Grey Aris. Oh, wrath! How she longed to turn back the clock of her life and not fail him, not betray him. But such things were impossible, and anyway, look what he'd become, how strong, how beautiful, A man worthy of a flawless woman, a woman who wasn't her. She tore her eyes from his and rushed from the hall, watching as Ennis turned the corner of a long corridor, his strides long, such that she would have to take 3 to 1 of his to catch up. She hustled along, but when she turned the same corner, he was gone and she was exhausted. Her daughter was stirring, her lips smacking as she searched for a snack. Rhea sank to her knees, her dress billowing around her legs like a canopy. Looking down at the purest face she'd ever seen, Rhea smiled. That's when she realized what she'd become. She was not a queen, not fate-marked. Friendless. Hated by those she'd spited. Lost to those she'd found. But she was something else. Something more. I am a mother, she thought, abandoning Western modesty and offering her breast to the most beautiful creature in the world. The babe sucked greedily.
I will not fail you, Rhea thought. If you are the one thing I do right, it will be enough.
A cleared throat made her flinch. Her eyes travelled up to find the most surprising person standing before her.
Ennis, she breathed. Rhea, I...
He trailed off, his shoulders sagging.
I can't do this. Not anymore. I hope you can understand.
She was so surprised by the emotion in his voice that she had to stifle a sob. She turned it into a small laugh, which caused him to raise an eyebrow.
You are different, he said.
She nodded.
Everything has changed.
She wore her ignominy around her shoulders like a cloak, but she willed it to vanish. One could not always look to the past, even if it was easier to see with clarity than the future.
Because of her?
He motioned to her daughter, who'd fallen asleep on her breast.
In part, she said. But you changed me too.
Ennis nodded thoughtfully.
And you, I. Ennis, I'm so... Don't say it, he said. No more apologies.
Rhea nodded. She couldn't deny him a single wish.
I wish I could change things, she said instead.
His eyes had become the eyes she remembered, back before she'd turned them into blades of steel.
Me too. We all have things in our past we want to forget, to change, but if we did, we'd be but shadows of ourselves.
His words surprised her almost as much as the fact that he'd returned.
Would that be worse?
Yes.
Even me?
Ennis sighed.
Though it pains me to say it. Even you.
She almost laughed, and for a moment it felt like the past, back when they were okay, back when they trusted each other.
Even you? What would you forget?
That I was loyal to you without regard for the truth. Any mirth on her lips fell away, his words like the knives that she deserved.
Is that supposed to make me feel better? No. Only you can make yourself feel better.
He ran a hand through his thick hair, looking boyish despite his age.
Your daughter. She's beautiful.
She could sense the unspoken words on the tip of his tongue.
Like you.
She was glad he didn't speak them. They would only make everything harder.
Thank you.
What is her name?
I haven't told anyone.
Nor had she told anyone about her daughter's fate mark, the beautiful symbols painted in light across the entirety of her skin. Images of people of all races and backgrounds, a tapestry of the 4 kingdoms, each nation connected by cords of white light. Rhea had sworn her midwives to secrecy.
Then let me be the first to hear.
Rhea seriously considered it. Sharing her daughter's name felt like her own form of magic. For a second, she hoped it would be the spell that would finally repair their broken relationship. But there was another who needed to know first.
I'm sorry. I cannot. Not yet.
Pain flashed across Ennis's face at the reminder that there was another who took precedence over him, who would always come first. He turned to go.
Wait. Ennis, please. Don't go.
I must, he said, no longer willing to meet her eyes.
You saw the enemy we face. Our only hope is to unite ourselves against the Horde.